The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Anybody know what this is? No. Yeah.
Stravinsky.
Stravinsky, Symphony of Psalms. Number of reasons it's a significant piece for our discussion. First, I think I've alluded to this before, but Stravinsky, in his Poetics of Music, 1938, says that music is pure architecture. It has no associations with human emotions, religiosity, whatever it might be. And he mentions specifically some of the things that people were said about his Symphony of Psalms and other religious pieces as being really off the beam. One reviewer said it had exactly the right combination of modern and Jewish sentiment that you would want to have in a psalm. And Stravinsky says, that's nonsense, I just wrote the music. Here's a great example of where I think a composer is very limited and wrong, whereas the music is very significant beyond what he realized. I mean, we've been told this a lot in critical hermeneutics and deconstructions, to the point where some people actually disdain the author. But in this case, I think the author is seriously in error in his theory about what happened in the music. The immediate subject of this is religious. It's the Latin from the Vulgate for a fragment of Psalm 38. Does anybody have a Bible here? A couple of you Christians. Here is it. In our translation, in our Bibles, it would be Psalm 39, 13 to 14. Well, there is no 14. No, it's actually the end of 38. O Lord, do not forsake me. Be not far from me, O my God. Come quickly to help me, O Lord, my Savior. So it's a psalm of lamentation, and then a psalm of asking God to be the comfort and to be our presence, to be His present with us in our dismay. And the music is meant, and I think succeeds in conveying the old and the new, and the new and the old. Stravinsky always wanted to have music be attuned to the ears of his contemporary listeners by being contemporary. At the same time, he had a very strong sense of tradition, particularly when he wrote religious music. His Mass and other religious music has links right back to the oldest known Christian musical traditions. And this certainly does. The opening little theme, that's a Baroque kind of theme that you could hear in church music from way back. The choral, very slow-moving homophonic sounds comes out of medieval tradition, and yet it's a distinctly modern piece. It was to be a symphony, but without 19th century lyrical sentimentality. Pierre Boulez says that Stravinsky's genius is to be one of the great simplifiers. And he attains great architecture and great objectivity through his musical simplicity. And this fits directly his belief that God is eternal, yet accessible through liturgy. Ernest Ansermé, a wonderful conductor, but an equally wonderful writer about music, music critic, says about the Symphony of Psalms that it expresses the religiosity of others who hear an imaginary choir by analogy to the earthly one. It is neither I nor you, but us. In other words, in this, Ansermé says, you can, because of its simplicity and because of its power and drive, there's a kind of choir behind the choir, and that makes you part of the community. And that's how I feel when I listen to truly great choral music, and I know it well enough to I feel that I'm entering into it, and it's taking me beyond. Now, Kivi would find problems with these types of statements, and I think what Kivi would say is that you can listen to this and get an awful lot out of it without feeling that you're part of a heavenly choir. But I think Ansermé's statement is meant to take us from the just literal theology of communion of the saints into sort a kind of musical type of communion of the saints, and that I think it really does. I see that in the Symphony of Psalms a kind of non-triumphalist cry to God, he does to me exactly the opposite of what he says in his poetics. He has associated religiosity. I don't know if it's Jewish or not, but it certainly has a flavor of the kind of lamentation and cry of the heart that you would expect from Old Testament spirituality. And here is the way I think music works. It takes you from where you are, puts you to a place, you know, chercher le thème, Kivi would say, by heuristics, where it wants you to be. And in the case of the Psalms, of course, it's coming very close to God. And I think this is evocative, it's emotive, it articulates emotions that are not just garden variety emotions, but it brings us to the place of sensing God's grandeur and glory. Now, I don't want to exaggerate, it's also just wonderful music, and you know, you could listen to this as a concert. In fact, it is a symphonic piece. It's not like Gregorian chant, which is not meant to be, quote, listened to. Oh, you can do it. It's all right. Yeah. You can. All right. Let me try this on you. Okay, this one, you may not know the exact piece, but you certainly know the tune, right? Which is? Oh, okay. I guess it is. Yeah, the St. Anne's theme. All right, who's the composer here? Not of that theme, which goes back, but of this particular piece? Yes, Bach said this. No, it's the St. Anne fugue. Yeah. Now, let's look for a second at symbolism. It's a very tricky subject because of the temptation to reduce music to a code. But this piece that you just heard is a self-conscious study on the number three. The melody da 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 has two times the number three. It's set in guess what key for you musicians? Flat, which has three flats.
That's the third scale.
Yep, that's the third scale. I mean, there's if we listened to the whole thing, we'd see that he really adds on every possible dimension. He has a triplet counter theme that runs there. Everything, it's just threes all over the place. Now, does this jump out at you when you hear it? No. Is it illegitimate? What's the point of it? Now, what you may not know is that the St. Anne theme is connected with the Trinity. So Bach is playing with that theme because of his love of the Trinity. However, would you say that somebody who doesn't know anything about Christianity listening to this piece would suddenly start thinking Trinity? Well, no. I mean,
I know something about Christianity, and I didn't start thinking.
You do know something, and you didn't start thinking. So it's certainly nobody who is even further away. But that raises the whole question of, well, is there any point in throwing numbers into music? And, I mean, this is something musicians love to do. Mozart, you know, wrote a little piece by throwing dice. Then that's an interesting remark, because it in serialized music or in indeterminate music, numbers became triumphant over everything else, to the point where you wonder whether there isn't anything else involved. That would be, Dooyeweerd would say, the modality, the numerical modality kind of took over all the others. All right, let me ask you this. Is there any biblical equivalent that you know of to using an artificial device like numbers to get across a spiritual truth?
Yeah.
What?
Like a shepherd. A spiritual truth of being guided. The staff, Aaron's rod.
Okay, you're talking about like...
numbers.
Are you talking numbers?
Yeah, I did say like numbers. I did say like numbers. It could be numbers. But a shepherd's staff...
Are you talking about something conceptual or something concrete?
I guess conceptual.
Okay, then forget that.
Well, because, I mean, there's obviously lots of metaphors in Scripture and illustrations. There's all kinds of analogies that way. So that would be fine. But I'm thinking something that seems completely unrelated. I mean, a shepherd's staff, you could, you know, take a few steps and get to God being our shepherd. But
like
numbers.
Vine and grape and wine and that kind of stuff?
Well, no, even more abstract than that. There's an obvious one that it's so obvious that you're missing. The number seven. Numbers. Bible uses numbers all the time for mnemonic reasons. Genealogies of Matthew, it's 3 times 14, is that it? Or 3 times 7. I've forgotten. But anyway, surely there weren't exactly 21 generations, you know, but so there's lots of numbers. What about with letters?
Well, the Psalm.
Mm-hmm.
Psalm 119.
Psalm 119 and others, what are they called?
Yeah,
acrostic psalms. What does letters of the alphabet have to do with conveying a spiritual truth? It's an interesting question. Kabbalists and numbers mystics will give you all kinds of connections, which I think are completely alien to what the Bible writers are trying to do. These are devices which Kivi would feel very much at home with because they're heuristic, they're puzzle solvers. Because God's world is a puzzle, it's perfectly legitimate to use seemingly artificial devices like number schemes. And especially numbers where there are beautiful patterns, like the number 7, you know, it has a middle digit and then 3 on each side and all that sort of stuff. Letters, you know, in Psalm 119, starting with a different letter of the alphabet does two things. First, it forces you to think of new material, which you might not have thought about had you not set yourself with this little obligation. And second, it shows you that there's order in the world, and that order in turn can be used to memorize and to put order into your own life. And indeed, the acrostic psalms more than likely were used for memorization, and that wasn't the only purpose. I think ultimately the purpose is just that it's fine to play with numbers or letters. But it does have that device. Now, back to Bach. Does the fact of his threeness get us to the Trinity? Well, no, not in any obvious way. But in the sense that we live in an ordered world, that he is made to discover things that he wouldn't have discovered if he hadn't given himself this obligation. In the sense that there's you can learn things this way. Sure, that reminds us of the Trinity, because God made this world, and God is a God of order. God is God is one person in three, and so on. One God in three persons. So, again, I think you don't want to say it's just a silly game, which has nothing to do with music. The romantics with a belief in pure music, art for art's sake, had no time for mixing things up with numbers. But neither do you want to say that it's irrelevant. Numbers has a lot to do with God's world. All right?
Puzzle.
You're not.
Okay. I mean, but give me another example besides letters or numbers.
In the Bible?
No.
Or you mean of any in anything?
I dropped off.
A sonnet.
I dropped off the book somewhere.
Okay. A sonnet. How many lines does it have? Well, at least one kind of sonnet.
14.
Mm-hmm, 14.
It has to have so many.
Mm-hmm. Rhyme scheme. Some of them have pentameter. I mean, so forth and so on. What? Why? How silly. If you ask it in a secular way, if you ask it recognizing that this world is a world full of intriguing order and puzzles, and that you recognize that mathematics is real and so forth, then it's a marvelous heuristic way to discover spiritual truths. And that's what poetry is all about. I mean, I remember in high school, why are you saying a poem? You could have just said the sun is rising. You don't have to, you know. Okay. Well, because a poem makes us travel down a road. It's an adventure. It's a verbal adventure which opens up horizons. I mean, there's a whole lot more to it than that. There's beauty to it. There's symmetry. There's sounds that are pleasurable, and so on. If there were no place for that, everything would just be laboratory reports. You know, straight prose. More convinced? Think about it. Oh, no. It's a question of point of view. It's not, you're not slow. Okay, here's yet another thing.
Was that part of the three voices in that
fugue? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, three voices. And a three-part fugue also.
Oh.
It's all very... It's... It's not the funny part yet. What's that? These next two are related not an obvious way, but that doesn't help at all. But who knows what this piece is? What century would you place it in?
20th.
Not quite. I think that's wrong. Yeah, it's late 19th. I think that's wrong. I don't remember the date.
No.
It's not Wagner's Country. Yep. Yep.
That's
Debussy.
That one,
Stuff Will Be the Middle. Is that what you're laughing about? Spaghetti Western? Yeah. Yeah, the muted trumpet. This is a piece called La Mer.
What?
Okay.
It is.
I must have missed that particular movement.
Well, I won't disappoint you by saying it doesn't have movements. Actually, it does have three sort of movements. We just talked about musical symbolism and numbers. There's a lot of deliberate symbolism in this. Maybe instead of making you guess, I'll tell you what some of it is. Debussy believed in composing, at least when he got to this point in his life, in cell units. And each of these cells was structured in a certain way, often by repeating everything twice. You know, or sometimes backwards, you know, or upside down, retrograde, whatever. It's appropriate to pick the ocean or the sea as a theme because the waves to him seem to do that, up and down and up and down. It's a musical illustration of the sea, which has an eternal flow of moments. To continue along this, he uses a certain scale, which a lot, which is used to show the movement of the ocean. Do you know what that scale is? It's not the diatonic scale. He was very fond of the pentatonic scale, but this one is something else. It's called the whole tone scale, and as you know, the diatonic scale is things like whole half, whole half. Whole tone scale is just whole, and it has the effect, at least it did in the late 19th century, of making you feel unstable or uncertain. And that's one of the purposes of it compositionally. But another purpose of it compositionally is to tend towards musical egalitarianism. Each note has a relationship to the other, which is not hierarchical or privileged or more stable or more final, but it's simply another note in the scale. And in order to remove from a traditional idea of a resting point or of, let's say, tonic with functional harmony, he used the whole tone scale a lot. The timbre, which is the sound quality, predominates over musical development. People call this kind of music impressionistic, although I think that's somewhat misleading, because the Impressionists weren't quite doing that same thing. But anyway. Debussy did say about his music that he wanted to move away from the canons of form in the 19th century and wanted to tend towards a more Eastern universal. In his diary, he records answers that he gave to a person who interviewed him And to the question, where would you rather be than here? He answers, anywhere out of this world. And he wanted music to be a vehicle for putting you out of the world. Now, some people have considered Debussy to be the father of modern music because of this. I think he's a pivotal figure, but I'm reluctant to use a kind of evolutionistic model that says he's the father of, you know, Schoenberg, and Schoenberg was the father of Boulez or whatever. But there is a musical tendency here which was exaggerated and extended by a certain kind of 20th century composer. And just to give you this last example, here is probably the purest musical egalitarianism that's ever been written, where timbre is all there is, but it's based on a pure number system. It's meant to show a lot of different things, but it's meant to show that nothing has hierarchy, not just notes, but people, the universe, everything is relative. Let me play the piece and then I'll discuss a little bit about how he does that. If I remember to record it. Yeah. Oh no, this is the next to last one. Okay, well, I'll play the next one in a row. Not by much. Here's the next piece. I know what this is. This'll do. Did you ever see Green Card? Gérard Depardieu. He's a composer, and he's at this very respectable dinner party, and they ask him to play a piece, and he goes. Yeah. The movie Green Card. Yeah. See if the piece I wanted got on this. If it didn't, we will stop there. But that'll do for purposes of illustration. All right. The next last piece. Any guesses to who wrote that?
Sure.
Yes. And it was 19, maybe 12 or 13. It wasn't that far into the 20th century. But there, the principle of composition is tending towards pure egalitarianism, and it's known as 12-tone or dodecaphonic writing. And the idea is, if you think of your palette of available notes in the Western system, you realize that there's only 12 different notes in the keyboard. I mean, there's octaves and things, but they're kind of the same. And so the 12-tone system, seeking to affirm the essential equality of every note, or putting it much more negatively, the pretension and the usurpation of any note that would claim to be more important than any other, developed a system of writing melodies which required that an entire sequence of 12 notes be played in order, in a fixed order, before any other notes could come in. And when they did, they had to have the same order, or they could be played backwards or upside down. So that piece has a lot of that, you know, da-da-da-da, you know, or whatever. And not only were these notes to be played horizontally in sequence, but the chords were determined by these same relationships. So let's say your first three notes are, I don't know, D, G, and A flat. Then you could have a chord, and then play the other notes, so that the entire piece becomes much more of a mobile of constant motion, rather than a linear, organically connected journey from A to Z. And that's quite self-conscious. The composers in that school meant to give us a kind of window onto equality, and for some it was a very mystical window. Anton Webern believed that if you made the notes really equal, listening would become a mystical experience which would open you up to what he called the word or the verb, which was some sort of principle behind the universe. Whereas Boulez, who was the composer of that last piece, is an atheist, and he simply believed that music should help you realize that the present is all there is, the past doesn't mean much, and so forth and so on. He was a Hegelian, and that piano piece is one of the most radically dodecaphonic pieces ever written, because everything is ordered according to this number sequence. He has these elaborate charts where these sequences are given every possible implication, including how loud and how soft you play. He got this arbitrary system of quintuple piano to quintuple forte, and so that's 12. And so you then order your dynamic. It's really hard to play this, you know. Absolutely everything, you know, chords. He's got orchestral. The one I was hoping that was on here, which I will bring in sometime, is the Marteau sans maître, where he has an orchestra doing this. And he has each instrument chosen for 12-tone reasons, including the human voice, which he makes disappear into the rest as a statement that the humans are nothing more than just a part of the whole and part of nature and so on. Now, the reason for giving you all this is not to just scare you about modern music, because actually that's a very long and complicated story, but is to show what happens when a principle like music alone gets exaggerated and removed from a larger framework where your cognitive perception is not because you're the image of God, but because you're a part of a machine, a cog. And so I think the corrective to Kivi, who is so insightful about how music should be indeed alone in the sense that it's a purely musical experience, is that if you have a framework where God is the author of all of this, then hierarchy is not a threat to you. Tradition is okay. A heuristic journey down a path is fine. You don't have to, you know, rebel philosophically against the inequality of notes. It's almost laughable to think that 12 tones is some kind of answer to social inequality and authority and so on. The next step is to burst beyond Western instruments into either electronic sounds or things like happenings and so on. I mean, there are there are, quote, concerts in which you'll see a model of a city on a stage, and somebody will come along with a blowtorch and burn it up. And that's music. That's the concert. You know, that's it. Because you don't want music to have anything to do with notes, because that might be hierarchical. That might be elitist. And you don't really just want it to have to do with sounds, because that's awfully related to notes. So why not just have it a happening, you know, burning up a model? I think the Kivi's system in and of itself doesn't prevent pure music from becoming this kind of incredible abstraction. But it does, I think we can benefit a lot from his warning us against reductionism. That's what I get out of it. Warning us against reducing music to stimulus, reducing it to a picture, reducing it to a garden variety emotion, etc., etc. It is a purely musical experience, but music is never pure. Music is always related to the whole context in which we live. And he, for him, he admits that, but he says, it's not my business to tell you how that works.